Kai Rizdahl. Coming up, meet the hedge fund manager who has invented something he calls the Human Misery Index and find out how it's helped him build his own pyramid. The challenges of buying sex in Thailand with Bitcoin. Also, we reflect on the economic legacy of Anders Breivik. And good news for Americans struggling to pay their bills, your teeth could be a great source of extra cash. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
it's Chapo, guys. It's Chapo, episode 11. We're back. On this week's show, we will not be talking about the marketplace, but we will be speaking
Fuck the market.
We'll be speaking with celebrity journalist Matt Taibbi. We'll be breaking down everything you were mad at this week about the Brunig ultimatum and probably some other stuff. So what do you say? Should we start the show?
Yo, fuck Marketplace. This is Marketplace.
Merc 'em all. Chapo. Let's go.
Bang, bang.
Okay, we are back. It's Chapo Trap House, episode 11. It's me, Will Meneker. And again, just like last week and the week before that, I'm with Matt Christman.
Booyakasha.
And Felix Wagwan.
Hello, everybody. Bumba Blood Clots included.
So, yeah, as I said, in a little bit, we'll be speaking with our first mega guest on the show, a little journalist known as Matt Taibbi. And we had a conversation with him about the election and a lot of the stuff that has been in our wheelhouse before, but we got a chance to talk to Matt about that, and it was really cool, and we think you guys will enjoy that interview. But before then, just want to update you guys on our ongoing campaign against the iTunes News and Politics podcast charts. What do you think?
Yeah, let's tell them how many skulls have paved our path to Damascus.
Okay. Now, I'm learning about this as we go. Like, the iTunes charts sort of fluctuates day to day. So the highest I believe we hit this week was 38, and we did beat the Ben Shapiro show and the Ezra Klein show at least once this week. I think now, actually, someone just sent me a shot that we're actually in at 69 right now. So nice,
nice,
sweet. It's been up and down. We cracked the top 40 one time this week. And like I said, we beat Ezra Klein, we beat Ben Shapiro, but like still ahead of us is Louder with Crowder. I think like Louder with Crowder is like in the top 20. I mean, fuck knows why, but he's the next one to get slayed this week. So again, encouraging everyone, when this show drops, download that shit on iTunes, leave reviews, like download it on your works computer, or like do whatever it takes, because
subscribe, apparently that's important as well. Subscribe.
Oh yeah, subscribe to us on iTunes. I want to beat Crowder, obviously, but like
I have to believe that there are more Chapo heads out there than whatever fucking state-mandated, chemically castrated mutants are listening to the Steve Crowder show.
Well, there are a lot of sex offenders in America.
It's like when you're living in one of those trailer parks for only sex offenders, there's not a lot to do, you can't really go anywhere, so you're probably listening to podcasts a lot, and the podcast you're listening to is Louder with Crowder, obviously.
If you listen to Louder with Crowder, you have to go door-to-door in any neighborhood that you move into. Hey, everybody, I'm a Crowder head. And also, in 1993, I...
there's a couple shows, actually. Okay, there's Louder with Crowder. We beat the Ezra Klein show, which, by the way, I looked at his guest list this week, and it's a fucking horror show. He talked to Grover Norquist. He talked to Cory Booker about spirituality. He talked to Cory Booker about spirituality, and
oh my god,
he talked to Neera Tanden, who we'll actually be talking about later in the show. So I've made a vow to actually expose myself to this, and hopefully we can discuss it and maybe find some audio to destroy later in the week. But there's two other shows that are ahead of us. One of them is a show, it's another Vox podcast called The Weeds. And surprisingly, it's actually not about smoking weed, but it's about getting into the weeds, which is where all the wonk policy details are. And it's like,
I consider myself wonk curious.
And someone, one of my little birds told me that they listened to it, and he said it was literally 10 minutes of Matt Iglesias and Ezra Klein talking about different kinds of tie knots. So, holy Christ.
Jesus.
Oh my, Christ. Dude, I'm going to be thinking about the knot I'm going to tie around my neck listening to that shit.
I'm swearing fealty to the Islamic State.
But, okay, so the number one spot on the iTunes News and Politics chart is a show called Keeping It 1600. They're keeping it 1600. It's not Hamilton, the podcast, but check this out. It's a show hosted by Jon Favreau and Dan Pfeiffer. Like, okay, why they gave the director of Iron Man a podcast to talk about politics, I have no idea. But no, it's these two guys, Jon Favreau and Dan Pfeiffer, who used to be like the young White House advisors. Like, they're not the Ben Rhodes Savage. They're basically characters from Veep, you know, if you watch that show. They're like Dan on that show if he was like a real person.
Oh yeah, well no, I was just saying that like John Fabestar and Michelle Pfeiffer's son, they're like, yeah, you may think that they're like, you know, oh, I'm gonna put on my suit and tie and talk about politics, but they've been known to drink a beer, they've been known to listen to Jay-Z, and they're not afraid to dish out a little snark.
They're like, snark by the Solo Cup. Like, there's photos of these guys at, like, you know, like, costume parties, like, you know, playing beer pong and shit. Like, they're like, yeah.
They, so, like, cover themselves in IOUs, and they go as, like, the federal deficit or some fucking thing that makes you
They wear a shirt that says, like, ad hominem, and they're like, I'm Donald Trump's campaign.
So anyway, Jon Favreau, the star of Swingers and the director of Iron Man, and Dan Pfeiffer,
is Jacob Weisberg with us?
So they're the White House bros that are holding down the number one. They're in our spot at number one. So seriously, we can hit number one on the news and politics chart. I'm convinced of it. And like, we can.
I believe,
like,
in the Chapo Nation.
Like, fuck yeah, dude.
Felix, as you said before about Diggler, like, we are Ramsey Bolton taking over the Dreadfort, and like, that number one spot is ours, and we're gonna fucking, like, you know, we're gonna flay all the rest of these goofies.
Hey, a naked White House former speechwriter has few secrets. A flayed one has none, and he's not even on the fucking chart.
So that number one spot is ours for the taking, and I think you guys, Chapo Nation, I think you guys can help us do it. And I know you're down to ride or die for us, and you know we're down to ride or die for you. But that number one spot on the charts is ours, and we're fucking gunning for it. Okay, so that's the house cleaning for this week. What say we go into this interview with Matt Taibbi?
Let's do it.
Okay, Matt, thanks so much for coming to The Trap, but we wanted to talk to you about a couple articles that you wrote for Rolling Stone over the last couple weeks, and let's just get into it right away. In your first one, RIP GOP, the party of Reagan is now the party of Trump. I guess what I want to ask you is the GOP really dead, and if so, what will take its place?
I mean, it's a good question. If you look at the way the polls are running on the down ticket races, there's a strong argument to be made that actually the party's doing great, and that were it not for this weirdness that's going on in the presidential election, that the party would be ascendant. However, what happened at the presidential race is unprecedented. And clearly, especially if he goes on to win the White House, it'll completely change what the Republican Party stands for. And I think a lot of these divisions that have come up since he seized the nomination, I don't think they're really curable, because there are too many people who have feelings that are too strong about this that that rift won't ever be healed.
I mean, I sort of imagine it like they're like the thing, and Donald Trump has blasted them with the flamethrower, but like just some part of it is going to like detach from the whole, sprout legs, and spawn a new abomination. So
that looks exactly like Bill Kristol.
But I guess it's just like what will that abomination look like is what I'm wondering.
I think one of the things that the Republican leaders have to look at is that whatever they were using before rhetorically to get people who are Trump voters to vote for them, it's just not working anymore. They need something different. And one of the things that's going on with Trump is that he's directly pointing a finger at the Republican establishment and saying, you're being ripped off by these people. These people have been selling you a line of goods for 30 years. All the jobs are gone. I'm going to give you your job back. So unless they come back with something that's like, we're going to give you your job back, you know, they're screwed. I don't see how they can come back with the same, you know, Ayn Rand philosophy of, you know, zero government and, you know, no protectionism, no nothing. And isn't that great? It sounds great in theory, but it just, after a while, people need to eat, you know, and that's what Trump voters are. I think that's what it's at the root of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, well, but Kevin Williamson has a plan where everybody leaves their hometown and lives in tent cities outside of major metropolitan areas looking for jobs. Yeah. You don't think that's going to resonate?
Is that a real thing?
No.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin Williamson, in one of his columns that he writes, wearing an opera cape, wants to make big American tent cities. He wants to return to feudalism, but Kevin,
that's great.
Bringing up Kevin's interesting. We're probably going to see a death of a lot of the Republican private welfare circuit, where we have all these publications and think tanks like, you know, Weekly Standard or National Review that don't make any money. And all these think tanks like the Milton Friedman Center for Liquidating the Underclass and the Bahraini Institute for Protester Studies. All these guys, you know, it's like Philip Green in the movie Casino.
Right.
They thought that they gave him all this money because he was so fucking smart.
Now, here was the perfect front man. I mean, what the fuck else could he be? He didn't know too much.
That's what's, I mean, to me, that's the really fun, like, delicious aspect of the story, is that all these people, I think, actually thought that they had some kind of popular support out there, that people really dug what they were saying. And now what they're finding out is that people hate them. Like, they hate them worse than anything, you know?
Well, you bring up that by way of that unbearable Andrew Sullivan article in New York Magazine from a week ago. So, I mean, I guess I want to ask you about that. Did you read Plato in college? And if so, are you a fan?
I didn't read Plato in college. I have to say.
Well, that explains everything.
I want to quote from your piece right now, because I think this is a very nice distillation of a lot of the things we've been talking about. But you write, this avalanche of verbose disgust on the part of conservative intellectuals towards the Trump voter, who until very recently was the Republican voter, tells us everything we need to know about what actually happened in 2016. There was never any real connection between the George Wills, Andrew Sullivans, and David Brookses, and the gun-toting, Jesus-loving, ex-middle-class voters they claim to embrace. So, yeah, it's like, you know, they're realizing that they're completely alienated from these people, and a lot of them are lashing out in really angry ways. And I just want to wondering if have you seen these? I want to bring up two op-eds that were in the Washington Post just this week. The first of which was by Robert Kagan, and it was basically, you know, Trump, this is what fascism looks like when it comes to America.
Right.
Like,
right.
What do you make of that? They're now like, this is the specter of what fascism looks like in America, is this kind of garish billionaire strong-arming his way into the presidency. And right. not, for instance, like George W. Bush landing on an aircraft carrier and, like, you know.
right. Taking a page straight out of, like, the Soviet May Day parade visuals book. They're very polished, that all those people at writing the op-ed about how populism is dangerous and over-emotional and we have to wait it out, but they usually write it about Occupy Wall Street or whatever the leftist craze of the moment is. They just haven't had to deal with it on their own flank for a long time, or they've kind of had a nervous detente with it. I think, you know, there were moments when, for instance, like the religious right pushed things that was a little bit out of their comfort zone. I don't think George Will was really all that into, you know, Terry Schiavo's feeding tube. That story didn't move the needle for him at all. You know what I mean? But they kind of let it go because they had that political alliance. This now they just don't know what to do. Now they're, you know, they're kind of on their own.
By the way, I have to give you props for it, because in this article, it's almost a throwaway line, but when you called George Will a spinster, I was like, oh, homie, oh my God. But the one other article that was in the Washington Post this week, it was from this guy who's at the Federalist. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I think it's David Harrisy or something like that. And just the headline was just, we need to weed out ignorant voters from the electorate. it's the eugenics strategy for the ballot box.
Thank God that Andrew Sullivan is involved now.
It's going to bust out the calipers.
The only way to stop a racist demagogue is a racist scientist.
It's really funny.
It should be noted that this guy, David Harrisy, also wrote an article claiming that we need to bring back dueling.
That's great. What else did he say in the piece? I didn't see it.
Oh, it's just, it's like he was just saying, like, by all means, expand access to voting, but like, let's also have like a Federalist sponsored essay contest, like, you know, before you can actually pull them. He was like, voters, they don't understand the Constitution. They need to revere the Constitution in the same way I do.
The sudden overweening concern with the low information voter, with the rise of the low information voter, that's another hilarious comic subplot to this whole thing. like they didn't, you know, make their way to the White House four or five times in the last, you know, four decades using exactly those people to get elected. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, these people used to be, like, the NASCAR dads, and now they're, like, you know, like, the zombies, like, you know, banging to get into the House or something.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No, they did that whole worshiping at the altar of the regular person act for decades, right? I mean, dating back to Nixon, I think that was really their major electoral strategy was, you know, the Democrats are the party of the elites, they're snobs. I mean, remember Joe McGinnis? He wrote that book, Selling of the Presidency, 1968. Nixon was the president of every place that didn't have a bookstore. and that's really the way they've been running their elections for, you know, going back to 1968. They've been targeting those voters and sort of lauding that person as being the good, decent, hardworking American against whom are arrayed all these powerful interests, mostly on the Democratic Party. Let's just listen to Sarah Palin's speech. You know, her whole speech is about people from the small towns who do all the work, right? And now it's those people, very people who are coming for them, and you're right, to them it's like a zombie movie.
They're mindless walking corpses, and many of us will be too if you don't stay focused on the task at hand. Zombies, man. They creep me out.
It's firing the help 30 years later.
Right, exactly.
I mean, these people are opportunists first and foremost. You know, they want to keep their jobs. They want to keep their sinecures. The ones who decide to sort of eventually make peace with it and try to ride the populist wave, even though it goes against all of their instincts and their breeding or whatever. Right. It'll be fun to see which ones are the first to sort of tumble like that. It'll be nice to see if David Brooks
is already, he's headed in that direction somehow. I it'll be really weird to see what comes out when he actually makes that effort, you know, that whole going out into the pain thing. I mean, are we going to have scenes of,
I think David Brooks should get addicted to OxyContin. I think he should start now.
Yeah, David Brooks is going to become one of, you know, like all the people I knew growing up in the Midwest. He's going to start a Facebook and start posting about how failure is exactly like success. And when you get a DUI, that says more about the cop than it does say about you. And, you know what, child support? That's fucking bullshit. That judge had it out for me.
That's really funny.
It'd be amazing if he came out of that crucible and he's just like Kurt Schilling now, and it's just he's totally on board with the whole thing. It's like I've seen the light.
And with the aesthetic too, because remember his whole bourgeois bohemians thing was not only the upscale sort of Republican Upper East Side person. They were not only the ultimate in political views, but they also had great taste in everything. So I'm sure if he has to go the other direction with Trump, the Trump voters, then he's going to be.
I mean,
I want to see him on Face the Nation in a Who Farted T-shirt.
he's going to be the Larry the Cable Guy cut off,
like
a chambray Oxford shirt.
He's going to have to go all the way over in that other direction and write a book about like Trailer Chic and everything. It's going to be hilarious.
I've always liked this. It'll be like in Spinal Tap when they kept changing genres.
Right, right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
You are witnesses at the new birth of Spinal Tap Mark II. Hope you enjoy our new direction.
Matt, another thing we wanted to ask you about as a seasoned observer of the beast, as a guy on the campaign trail, a boy on the bus, as it were, covering this year's election and all the different campaigns, like which candidate, in your opinion, had your favorite supporters? Or was there a specific type of person or candidate who had like the best crowds, in your opinion?
Definitely. The Cruz people, the Carson people were definitely crazy. There were a lot of crazy people out there this time. And the Trump voters, I'm going to probably regret saying this, but I didn't find a lot of that in their crowds. I found a lot of people who were like ex-union types, in places like New Hampshire where there used to be a factory, for instance, right? Like, I met a guy who, believe it or not, used to work at a tampon factory. And he's a Trump voter now. There's no tampon factory in the town anymore. They're just mad. They're not entertainingly crazy. Whereas the people who supported Carson and Ted Cruz, they were some pretty confused people, definitely. They were funny.
I went to New Hampshire, and yeah, the thing that I noticed were the Kasich, like my favorite group was the Kasich people because they were all like really weird photogenic Mormon people.
Oh, the Mormons.
That's right.
Well, you two boys can just fuck right off.
Who was very excited that you were there for John Kasich. The Ted Cruz people were just bewildering bow tie dipshits and psychos. The Ben Carson people were like, yeah, they were like Heaven's Gate members.
Right, yeah, exactly.
The Trump people were what you would expect. They were like middle class people with a shitload of anxiety and rage
and some way too much TV.
Yeah,
they just what all their information came from like TV and Facebook, right? Yeah,
yeah.
But the Ted Cruz people are the kind of people who had to give you a lecture about the Constitution within 30 seconds of meeting them. You know what I mean?
Our joke about the Ted Cruz supporters were that they were like they just love this debate team. Like, oh, by your logic, you just proved my point with an ad hominem fallacy.
Oh yeah, oh god. Yeah, that's terrible. Yeah, they are like that.
So, Matt, we've talked a lot about true comedy and bizarre freaks and weirdos that have been exposed in the Republican crack up. And it's horrifying because it's the rise of this racial demagogue and the exposure of a lot of stultifying fear that exists in a lot of these people. But it's baseline funny. It's baseline pretty funny.
Right, right. Yeah.
But the other party crack up that we wanted to talk about that you talked about in your article that the Democrats have just sort of barely survived is the Democratic one.
Yeah. No, I think it's funny. At the beginning of the campaign when people were making the kind of facile comparison between Sanders and Trump, I found that annoying at first because I didn't think that they had anything in common at all. But actually, the campaigns are hitting a lot of the same notes and. Even though Bernie is almost a totally opposite personality to Donald Trump, they're pointing out similar things about the the basic corruption of the two-party system and how it doesn't really work for regular people. And the Democratic Party is having a harder and harder time getting their base to listen to them. And this election cycle, they managed to survive. They had a candidate who had incredible name recognition and familiarity. But it's devolved, and I think there's a rift in the party now on the Democratic side that's almost as big as what's going on on the Republican side. And likely what's going to happen, my guess, is that this Sanders coalition is going to carry on, and in 4 years you're going to see another candidate who has the same politics as Bernie, but ends up taking over the party. I think that the Democrats at least are probably smart enough to see that this is the way it's going to have to go.
I think you were discussing how Wall Street has become like not a target for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, no, it struck me throughout the last 8 years that they had a lot of political ground that they could have gained by doing a couple of things. First of all, there was this incredible moment after the crash in 2008 and 2009 when Obama first got elected, where if he had sat down at the beginning of his presidency and had a couple of speeches where he just sat down and said, look, this is what happened, right? and used those amazing communication skills of his and said, there was this criminal fraud scheme in the mortgage markets that, everybody got screwed and we're going to sort it out now. We're going to make new rules to make sure it doesn't happen anymore. If they had done that, they would have won the middle class for the next generation. And instead what they did is they just kind of kicked the can down the road a little while and passed off what happened as a kind of like a weather event, the 1,000-year flood, and made everybody whole again with bailout money and papered the whole thing over. And it was a tenuous political position to have, and Bernie completely just blew a hole in it with his campaign against Hillary, who unfortunately for the Democrats has this very graphic tie to the worst actors in the crisis. So I think they made a gargantuan mistake doing that, and that's what this rift is about.
Yeah, but now we're seeing. I mean, what do you make of this idea that like the anger on the Democratic side between Hillary and Bernie, the exact moment when Hillary's victory is assured, as they keep telling us, they're more furious than they've ever been at Bernie. What do you think of this idea that they're trying to cast Bernie as the Nader, or they're already preparing to blame him if they lose to Trump?
Yeah, no, I don't. It's hard to say how much of that is real and how much of that is messaging, because I know for a fact, talking to people on the Hill, that they have a strategy with Bernie, which is to cast his supporters as violent, sexist, unhinged, low information, and over emotional, and that's what they're trying to do to try to take the move the conversation off where Bernie is trying to put it, which is your candidate is taking cash from the worst sectors in the financial crisis, and they've been very successful at that. So I don't know whether that anger is manufactured or whether it's real, but it's interesting. As a political strategy, it's working, because we're talking about that, and we're not talking about Hillary right now, so that it's effective.
The thing that worries me, though, about the ascendant Sanders coalition, which I agree with you, demographically has a lot of power and is going to sort of inevitably have even more influence going forward, is that they were able to rally around Bernie, and Bernie was able to so effectively create this because he was not a Democrat.
Right.
Because the Democratic Party is this fatally compromised institution that everyone, including, as we're seeing, at least about half of the people who consider themselves Democrats, recognize as such. And the danger from the thing I worry about is anybody who's going to come after Bernie presumably is going to be a Democrat, just because he is such a unique figure in American politics. There's really nobody like him in terms of being an independent with that kind of national profile. So, is there... Are there anybody in the lower levels of the Democratic who are actually within the Democratic Party but are able to stand apart?
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that there are plenty of politicians who are already in office on the Democratic side who sort of recognize that there's a lot of room to move politically in that direction. You know, you look at Elizabeth Warren. I'm blanking on the guy from Oregon, right? Jeff Merkley. You know, there are people like that who have already seen that from a patriotic point of view, it's necessary to clean up this corruption. You know, you forget that there's a right thing to do in all of this. You know, but they're doing that. And then B, that's where all the votes are. If you hammer, you know, Jamie Dimon in a senatorial hearing, then that's gonna be popular. That's gonna go viral.
I mean,
I just don't know how many young politicians there are out there who are gonna have the chops to do that. You're right.
But like, let's say you're Hillary Clinton and you're worried that, like, you know, the youth vote is gonna turn against you. I mean, I guess it just amazes me, like, how easy would it be for her to just co-opt one of the things that Bernie Sanders has made his platform? I mean, even insincerely, but it's like, she can't even do that. She can't even do that because it's just like, she doesn't believe in it, or like, I don't know why.
Every time in history, the Clintons have gotten hit, they move to the right.
Like, yeah.
If Bernie had won Kentucky, I don't know, Bill would have gone out there in blackface or something. I don't even know. What they do never makes sense. It never ever made sense because they're surrounded by these, like, foot fetishists and losers and weirdos that they've kept on to them since 1988, who are like, all right, Hillary, you have to go out there and say that we should invade Yemen.
Okay, right.
Yeah, for all of that whole generation of politicians, it's the day after Mondale lost to Reagan.
Yeah. For the rest of history, that's going to be there. They're frozen in that moment. And they even said, you know, there was that story in the Times last year where Hillary's aides talked to the Times off the record and said, we would rather run this other campaign where we would run to the middle and go after the white middle class voter in the South. They don't want to run the Bernie campaign. You know, that's not who they are. You know, they could pick a running mate maybe who appeals a little bit more to the Bernie's voters, but their instinct is to go the other way. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Well, that leaves us a lot to look forward to this coming November. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
But Matt Taibbi, thanks so much for talking to us, man. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Happy to. Maybe later in the campaign, we should check in again.
Okay. We're back from that. That was Matt Taibbi, and of course, you can read him at Rolling Stone, and we'll be linking to
those. A little publication known as Rolling Stone, no big deal, whatever.
I think we're the new Hunter S. Thompson. I think that's pretty fair to say. But we're going to link to those articles, and and thanks again to Matt for coming on our show and just blessing us with a little bit of his celebrity.
Yeah, no, I imagine like most of you, I've been reading Matt Taibbi since I was like fucking 13, and I've always loved his writing. I like his obituary. Everyone talks about his obituary at Breitbart, which is fucking great. But his obituary of Yeltsin is just like one of the best things I've ever read in Rolling Stone. And we were nervous as fuck to have him on, but we think it went really well, and we were really, really happy to have him on. So thank you to Matt Taibbi.
I think that his campaign, Journal of 2004 campaign, which will go down in history as the stupidest thing ever, other than the current presidential campaign, of course. Spanking the Donkey is like an all-time great campaign journal, and I think it definitely influenced all of us the way we think.
Yeah, as people who traffic in political invective and vulgarity, I mean, like, there's really no one better. So it's awesome that he came on the show. So sorry, I just need to wash the taste of his dick out of my mouth there. But all right, so we said we would discuss it, and there's a lot here to talk about. It's obviously the thing that everyone was talking about since Friday, basically. It's the Brunig ultimatum, basically. And there's a lot to discuss here, but before we do, I feel sort of compelled to like do sort of a little disclaimer about how, like, look, we're going to talk about this and like the people involved in this. And obviously, like, you know, Liz is officially in the Chapo Mafia. Matt is a friend of the show. But like, I don't want to mistake this that like we're making them into like martyrs or anything, or I don't want to make this bigger than it needs to be, because like look, they're going to be fine. Like we're friends with them, but like I just don't want to do anything corny. Like we're making this into some kind of cause for our show, or that we're going to be like advocates on their behalf, because like they don't need it, and that shit is corny anyway.
Yeah, they can defend themselves. They're more than capable.
They're not the West Memphis Three or anything like that.
Yeah, and look, I mean, and we're also, you know, obviously we're going to talk about some of the principles involved in this spat with them. And you know, I mean, it should go without saying, I think a lot of them are risible and contemptible figures, but like, I have, you know, all of us has made fun of them, like both in and out of their mentions. So like, that's fine. But like, I don't want to make it a thing where like everyone is just like, you know, adding Chapo Trap House in like Joan Walsh's mentions or anything like that, because, you know, do what you want to do. But like, I just think that shit, it like is corny. And like, I don't want to, like, I just, like, I don't want to become, like, Milo. I don't want to become, like, Milo Yabba Dabba Duopolis, where just, like, random people are, like, adding us into their beefs to be, like, this woman said Mario Brothers is rape culture. Milo, annihilate this bitch. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, keep our name out of your mouths if you're going to, like, get in Twitter beefs or whatever. Like, do that shit on your own. And I'm sure we'll do it ourselves, but it's just, like, I don't want to become like some champion or fucking advocate for like other people. You know what I mean?
Yeah. At the end of the day, we do a podcast. It's pretty angry and pretty people, but mostly people like to laugh when they listen to it. And we like to think that, you know, we make your week a little bit better, and we don't want to go in this direction where we're spearheading obtuse moral causes that happened when like fucking dog mom for Bernie argued with shingles mom for Hillary, and we have to bring down all the Chapo bannermen. And I don't think you guys want that either.
No, it's sort of like about the baseball crank thing. Like, I thought that was funny, and there was like a joke attached to it, but like I was happy to put it to bed. And like the thing about like, you know, some of these people is that like I can't think of a joke that goes with it, you know, like it's just like I think these people are just kind of despicable, but like at the same time
they
I don't want to make
joke.
It. Yeah, exactly. So I think a good way into this whole topic was actually, I just want to read a paragraph from our good friend Amber Ali Frost, what she wrote this week in a current affairs article that I think turned out to be really prophetic, because she published it. It got published at the beginning of the week, and it was about like civility and vulgarity, and about how like the important uses of vulgarity in like political debates. So I just want to read this one paragraph from Amber, because I thought it was really good. She writes, "The left will always need its journals and polemic and academic writing, but there are times when it is both right and proper to terrify the bourgeoisie with your own feralness. Reclaiming vulgarity from the Trumps of the world is imperative, because if we do not embrace the profane now and again, we will find ourselves handicapped by our own civility. Vulgarity is the language of the people, and so it should be among the grammars of the left, just as it has been historically, to wield righteously against the corrupt and the powerful. We cannot cede vulgarity to the vulgarians. Collegial intellectuals will always be niche, but class war need not be." And again, I think that's a really nicely stated, and again, very prophetic, considering how things turned out for Matt this week.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, if you guys haven't read it, by the way, you should definitely read it. It's a fucking amazing essay, and we think it dovetails nicely with what our mission statement is. But
our mission statement about being the dirtbag left, basically, yeah. I think that's the niche that we want to hold down for now. Well, okay. First of all, like, should we say who Neera Tanden is? She's like the director of the Center for American Progress, right? Is that her official title? Okay, so she's the head of, or she's like one of the top positions in probably the most influential like liberal think tank in Washington. You think that's fair to say? Like outside the Brookings Institute, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, the president of the Center for American Progress, that's, I guess, if Brookings is like the Gambino family, because they have all that strong Qatari money, which is like the heroin trade money, the CAP, which Neera is the president of, the Capo de Tutti Capo, is, they're the Genoveses.
Okay, so Again, Matt called her a scumbag, and Matt Brunig, that is, not our our own Matt Chrisman, I'm sure, has called her worse.
To avoid confusion, for the purposes of the rest of the podcast, I will be going by Kush.
Okay.
So if you hear Matt referring to Brunig, not me.
All right. So again, Felix alluded to this, but okay, this is the person that he called a scumbag. Now, I want to just read from this email that came out. This is back in 2011, and this was from Nira. Subject line, should Libya pay us back? Great fucking subject line for an email. Here's what Nira wrote. We have a giant deficit. They have a lot of oil. Most Americans would choose not to engage in the world because of that deficit. If we want to continue to engage in the world, gestures like having oil-rich countries pay us back doesn't seem crazy to me. Do we prefer cuts to Head Start or WIC or Medicaid? Because we live in deficit politics, and that's what is happening and will be happening even more. So what I got to say to that email from Nira is, we're going to build the biggest invasion of Libya. It's going to be beautiful, a fabulous invasion, and we're going to make the Libyans pay for it. It's going to be classy. It's going to be wonderful. They're going to pay us back.
When I'm president, America's going to be strong. We're not just going to not spend money on bombs. We're going to get 10 times what we spent on the bombs back in oil money.
Yeah, I believe it was Chaz Bader on Twitter pointed out that there's like everything wrong with contemporary democratic politics is encapsulated in that. Not just the breathtakingly awful suggestion of making these people pay for their own bombing and using the just chilling Orwellian language of engage with the world to mean bomb the fuck out of places. Even the fucking British Empire at the height of their debauchery when they were starving millions of Indians to death and laughing about it, they didn't call that shit engaging with the fucking world. But worse than all that is that she's also endorsing the idiot consensus wisdom of Washington that there's this zero-sum game in terms of the budget because the deficit is this real thing that we have to be very concerned about at all times.
And no, like, yeah, it seeds the idea about, like, you know, that there's a deficit crisis and we need Libyan oil money to help us pay back, like, for WIC or Head Start or whatever. Like, there's not enough fucking money in this country to do that. And, like, actually, when I read this email again, it totally reminded me of our conversation with Derek last week, because, like, what did he say about the blob? Like, he said that, like, the number one trait about the blob is the unvarnished belief in the positive like force of the U.S. military to engage with the world, as Nira says.
Yeah, and also I want to point out, like, this is everything that people fucking hate about the Democratic Party. We included the evil, the fucking corporate sensitivity training language, but also it's fucking dumb. What government of Libya is Nira saying that we should get this from? One of the six competing factions that were at war with each other at the time? And also, yeah. How does that work? Do you just show up and go, well, the oil's ours now? Like, you can't do that without a fucking ground invasion. Like,
bomb the oil and take the oil. That's what I say. You bomb the oil and you take the oil.
So, yeah, like, I mean, this is the new model of, like, humanitarian intervention. Like, where you find the humanitarian crisis, you intervene, and then, like, you make your client state just pay you back with all of their resources that are now yours. I mean, but I think there's another point that's worth making about this whole exchange, is that he originally got into it with Joan Walsh, right? And the thing he got into Joan Walsh was ever, it was like, Joan Walsh wrote some article for The Nation, and again, why they allow her to publish this just speaks really poorly to the state of The Nation magazine and its current incarnation. But she basically made some point about the bullet graph was like, I'm not going to cede moral authority to, like, i.e. to the Bernie Sanders campaign or supporters, because, like, they are, like, you know, like, are erasing the voices of, like, you know, black, brown and women, like, who are speaking for Hillary, right? That's basically what she said. And Matt Brunig replied to her about that, where he's like, you know, the real breakdown is young versus old. And, like she insists, in perpetuating this idea that like the Bernie versus Hillary thing comes down to white men versus everyone else. And as Matt Bruning has showed with his, I think, quite painstaking demographic research, is that if you really look at it, it's if you're under 30, no matter what demographic you inhabit, you're going for Bernie over Hillary. And that includes, you know, white, black, brown, it crosses class, women, men. If you're under 30, that's the real split in the Democratic Party. It's not about race or gender or anything like that. But for the Joan Walshes of the world, it's incredibly easy and convenient. Like they depend entirely on this notion that the split between Hillary and Bernie is made up of white men on one side and everyone else on the other.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back to 2008. Let's go back to Joan Walsh's 2008 writings, where she talks about the angry white Clinton voters and how she completely empathized with them. I wonder what changed in those past 8 years that made Joan Walsh go to the point that she wrote a book called What's the Matter with White People, to the point where she puts a great spokesperson for her race in her bio, to the point where when she talks about going to vote in Harlem, where she absolutely is not pricing anybody out, she notes that everyone, all the Clinton voters in there, were black and Latino, except for her, plus me, the infamous plus me. Plus me.
You know, it's like for that whole crowd of, like, you know, Clinton supporters, for them, it's become this whole thing about how, you know, they're being harassed, and Matt Bruning has been like at the center of this vortex because, you know, he calls them out, and then all of his followers, you know, harass and intimidate them or whatever. And what I have to say to that is, like, look, if you're a woman online, like, chances are you have to deal with a lot of shit that guys don't, that is at best annoying and at worst frightening. So, like, I'm not going to deny that. But what I will deny, or at least what I will say, is I would take these arguments from these particular people more serious if they just didn't display the utmost cynicism in how they invoke it. And by that, I mean, like, it's not just that they dismiss any criticism of them that comes from people who aren't white men. It's that they don't acknowledge it at all. They just outright, like, they pretend it's not even there when it very clearly is.
Because there's basically two groups of people who are responding to this whole controversy in some sort of outrage. And on the one end, you have this very cynical group at the top that we've been talking about, who are totally just using this language of oppression to mask the fact that they're defending an essentially reactionary agenda for the ostensibly leftist party in America, and people are not happy about that. And so they want to confuse the issue, and they want to distract from that. That's their agenda. And so that's why they're going to push that narrative. But a lot of people are going to buy it for the simple reason that they don't want to confront, for a number of reasons, the terrifying reality that the fucking internet is just a giant shit tornado with a just this mass of totally uncontrollable, unknowable people. You have no idea who anybody is. They can do whatever the fuck they want. And this narrative of these directed attacks, where Matt Bruning has like 500 alts and then 600 minions directing attacks at these people, there's something comforting about that, because if you can like cut the head off of the snake, it'll die, and then maybe you can have peace in the kingdom. When the sad and terrifying reality is that there's a bunch of broke brained morons and fucking schizoids online who you have no control over. And that reality is too scary, and so people cleave to this narrative of these masterminds that just has no basis in reality.
And I also thought it was really interesting in our discussion with Taibbi, is that he said he's heard from people like in Washington that this is absolutely a planned strategy on the part of the Clinton campaign to portray Bernie Sanders and his supporters as sexist, racist, unhinged, you know, which is exactly what they're doing.
Right. And, you know, Matt just brought up the point that they're selling a story. Bernie Sanders has won probably a bigger proportion of votes from Arab Americans out of anyone who has ever run for president. I would think that's safe to say. You know, look, I have some problems with Bernie's foreign policy. A lot of people like me do. He's talked about continuing the use of drones. He likes our great allies in Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Jordan. But he's just so much less hawkish than Hillary Clinton. And the real narrative here is, I guess, that people don't like it when you, like Hillary Clinton, have a history of killing their relatives overseas. But that is just, that's totally ignored. Arabs are not people of color. Muslims are not people of color. And it's not that there's any special animus that you're Joan Walsh.
I might quibble on that point about Neera Tanden. Do you want to talk about what she said about Modi?
Oh, yeah, Neera Tanden. Neera Tanden did, she proudly
She said
met.
It was a great honor to meet with Prime Minister Modi of, by the way, the Prime Minister of India is an actual fascist whose political party has, carried out actual pogroms against Muslims that killed, thousands of people in the region of India that he was in charge of.
Right, Modi has led race riots that have killed thousands, far more effectively than dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know,
Modi is an actual evil person. He's an actual fascist. And Neera Tanden said it was a great honor to meet him, and he's an important part of the conversation about the economy or some bullshit like that. And yeah, this is the thing. It's been sort of our mission statement from the beginning. We said this in the Mediaite article, but Twitter and the internet and shit, it doesn't matter. I really don't think it has very many real world effects, other than just distraction and you know, just staving off the feeling of impending death. Basically, I think that's its probably biggest real world effect for me at least. And you know. Oh, I've been mean to people. I've made fun of people. That's fine. I don't care. I think a lot of this shit about harassment is blown out of proportion. But the thing I make an exception for is when these people, as they did to Matt, are actually snitching and trying to get people fired from their job because they were mean to them on Twitter. That to me crosses a line of they're. Stop snitching, people, really.
I saw a fucking editor from Reason condemn Matt with social justice language.
What?
I said this earlier this week. This is Matt's legacy. He fucking destroyed libertarians so bad for about 3 years that they became the hated social justice warriors and talked about the abusive bully Matt. Meanwhile, just happily going back to their publication where they talk about race and IQ. But... hey, you know what? Have fucking fun with that. But
guy gets finished writing the an article called "In Defense of Date Rape," and then he decides to condemn Matt Bruning for being a misogynist.
I'm a cute boy whom sells sugar. Go fuck yourself.
And here's the thing: it's easy to say that, this whole thing, Matt got fired because he was mean to someone. But I think, what this is really about is that it's the person he was an asshole to, and the person, was Neera Tanden, and he's done this to many other people before, but it was because he said a rude thing to Neera Tanden, who very well may be. An advisor in the next presidential administration.
They're saying she might be the fucking chief of staff in the Clinton administration.
Ah, great.
So, he ran afoul of, probably one of the more powerful people in, the sort of Democratic power establishment in Washington. And she probably snitched to Demos and probably got him fired because of that.
And that's what's important, is because it shows you that, for example, the Demos is now an organization that you just can't take seriously, because if you're going to make it your mission to speak truth to power, and then as soon as somebody in power calls you and says they don't like something your guy did, and you fucking sell them out, where the hell is – when are you ever going to be effective as an institution? Because these kind of arguments about tone can be made by anyone and at any time, and if they have a sufficient clout – enough people are going to give it, a cursory acceptance, and then boom, it's going to work. You have to draw a line and say, we're not going to be fucking intimidated by or manipulated by this shit, or else what is the chance you're ever going to be able to be an effective spokesperson for your views?
I mean, what I have to say about Demos is that I neither knew or cared about them before I found out who Matt started reading Matt Bruning, yeah. And I'm happy to revert to type and continue to not know or care about them.
Demos? Yeah. More like D's nuts. I think that there's a parable to be had here because you could see the same dynamic at play in every sense in the fake outrage about the Nevada Democratic Convention that happened last week, where the Nevada State Democrats basically pulled a fast one using their positions in the committees to deny the Sanders campaign delegates that they had fairly won in the previous round of county caucuses. People got pissed because it's fucking being disenfranchised. And there was a viral video of Barbara Boxer, sainted Barbara Boxer, progressive champion Barbara Boxer, getting booed. And people basically lost their shit and acted like these people were storming the Reichstag or something. And it turned into a narrative where not only did these people boo, but they were being violent. They were throwing chairs. They were throwing punches, maybe. And then people were tweeting and texting death threats to this the chairwoman of this convention.
By the way, I heard the death threats. It's like, dude, it's like fucking David the Milk Milkberg. It's like these guys who are like, you are a disgrace to democracy. I am ashamed of you. If you want to debate further, my number is... Like, they leave their fucking like numbers.
They're spurging basement dipshits who don't even fucking live anywhere near Nevada.
No.
And it's just a perfect example. Like everybody who ever told Nir Tenden or any of these other people that Bernie is supposed to have organized an harassment to gargle balls is his responsibility. And everybody, every random shithead, every fail son who had nothing better to do on a Wednesday afternoon than tweet death threats to this woman is the responsibility of the people in Nevada and the Sanders campaign, which is an insane standard that no one could live up to. And the same day that these people were getting outraged beyond measure at the fictional violence, which, by the way, included a RPG of dildos fired at Barbara Boxer that I tweeted about as a joke, and which hundreds of fucking Hillary supporters, starting with Amy Siskind, the former Puma.
Oh, that nutcase, right?
Fucking scumbag.
And got insanely outraged
about. Wait,
about.
Matt, hold on a second. Could you explain the dildo RPG thing that you did? Okay. You just so, like, we went by that too fast.
All right. So, I was seeing all these ridiculous freakouts about the Nevada convention, which as far as I could see, and which all we've seen, because all the stuff about chair throwing and violence has never been substantiated. It literally boils down to one secondhand tweet from some dickhead journalist and has never been seen in any photo evidence or eyewitness testimony. It's just total bullshit. But anyway, during all of this outrage, I decided to do patented irony, because I am, after all, an irony bro. And so I said, can't believe that Sanders supporters fired a RPG covered in dildos at Barbara Boxer. This is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And at first it was faved and retweeted by, you know, my normal band of garbage dicked irony friends. But then Amy Siskind, the unhinged Hillary supporter who has questioned Bernie Sanders' level of Judaism.
Oh, and also Barack Obama's level of Americanism, if we want to go back.
Right, because
she
was a Puma. She was one of the actual literal Pumas from 2008. She wrote an article endorsing basically McCain Palin because having a woman on the ticket made that ticket more feminist than Obama Biden. So she retweeted it, and I got hundreds of people in my mentions freaking out. I cannot believe this is happening. The Sanders campaign has to condemn this behavior. And it's something that no person on earth would take seriously for a second. But because
this is exactly
all
like
the people,
I was gonna say, this is exactly like what we talked about last week with Rod Dreher. It's like these people, no matter how fucking dumb it is, they just need to believe this shit. They want to believe these.
But like everybody, and the thing is, I got a couple Bernie bros who believed it too, and they were like, there's no proof that happened. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
Show me the evidence. And because what's happened is, and this is what I think sparks a lot of the so-called coordinated harassment that's really just people popping off, because politics in America is dead as a part of your life. Like, we don't live, we think of politics all the time, we talk about it, but it's generally as this spectacle that we absorb. We don't have a praxis, as they obnoxiously say in Marxist lingo. There's nothing we do on a day-to-day basis that constitutes making a political choice and asserting political ideology.
Christ knows I
don't.
All
we really do, we observe, and then we spout off online. And so what happens is that on the internet, specifically on Twitter, millions of people, fans of every candidate, basically have volunteered themselves to be part of the rapid response crew of a given campaign. And they're going to respond to everything thinking that they're helping, having the psychic, you know, satisfaction of thinking that they're helping the campaign. And because Twitter is just this fucking insane asylum of undifferentiated, context-free streams blasting into your face, it strips your ability to do any kind of rational, balanced analysis of things, any ability to challenge whether something is true, and you just become this raw nerve of response. You just have to reflexively respond to any stimuli in this way that's instantaneous. And that is what that's I think the generator of a lot of this shit. And it's not coordinated. It doesn't need to be. It's basically the pent up and unexpressed frustrated political will of millions of people being jizzed out onto the internet at the same time.
And again, I know I said at the beginning of this, this is not a cause or anything. Like, I'm not like making their problems my own, but you know what is a coordinated campaign of harassment? Exactly what Sadie Doyle and fucking Sarah Jiang are trying to do to Matt right now.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Fucking Liz had to get off Twitter because Sarah's band of tech failures and what the fuck, are you okay, guys? Sick fucking MRAs on Liz.
And it was Roosh, right? It was that motherfucker, the rape blog, the rape guy, literally. Like, that's
another,
his thing.
Roosh, another one of my evil twins. fucking, yeah, no.
He's Dark Universe Felix.
Yeah, he's Dark Felix. But fucking, you know, call me crazy, but a bunch of people saying gargle my balls or datey soil to you, it doesn't quite measure up to some unhinged but well-connected people calling somebody's employers and trying to take food out of their fucking future child's mouths.
That makes perfect sense, because what the very day that all of these Clinton supporters were getting mad about the fictional dildo cannon that I made up in Nevada, they were excusing and justifying Hillary man Wendell Pierce breaking into a female Bernie Sanders supporter's hotel room and kicking the shit out of her.
Did he really kick the shit? I thought he smacked her or what? What happened with Wendell Pierce?
He grabbed her hair, punched her in the face a bunch of times.
Holy shit.
And then you got people whose like motto in life is believe women.
Okay, hold on a second.
Well, you know, we don't know the whole story. We don't know what she said.
Hold on a second. I want to defend Wendell Pierce here for a second. It seems bad what he did, but let's keep in mind he probably was still in character as Clarence Thomas. You know, like that role took a lot out of him. I think we'll put a bow on this, but just suffice to say, read Amber's article about the politics of vulgarity. And I think it's just suffice to say that in our current situation, which is like basically the death throes of the American empire and like our planet choking out its last fucking gasps, a politics of civility is a politics that is neither productive nor effective. And just the last thing I'll say is never trust a snake, always roll with wolves.
Bang, bang, Chapo.
Okay, so before we end the show this week, two other bits of housecleaning I want to do. The first is I'm hesitant to do this, but I feel like I need to give a shout out to Nick Mullen's podcast that just started.
Yeah.
I'm hesitant to do it because I feel like if we hit people to come town, like my biggest worry is that all our fans are just gonna listen to it and be like, fuck Chapo, I'm a cum boy now. Come boys for life.
That said, it's fucking hilarious. I imagine that like most of the people who listen to us know who Nick is. Nick is like probably the funniest fucking person I've ever met in his life, and the podcast is
Like, it's just as funny as his fucking Twitter, as his stand-up, if you've been lucky enough to see that. Like, it's a must-listen.
Yeah, and again, remember I said last week I'm glad we chose the news and politics genre because it was so easy. I'm also glad that we're not in comedy to have to fucking compete against fucking Nick and then that chart.
Yeah, fuck no.
I want no piece of that. But seriously, Come Town is fucking hysterical. I listened to both episodes twice this week and was like, looked like an insane person on the subway doing it.
Yeah, I was just totally alone in my apartment, just screaming, the cat's clawing at the door. It's so fucking funny.
And also, we definitely are gonna get Seth Dickfield to come on the show soon.
Seth Dickfield is a budding Hillary, man.
Seth Dickfield is we definitely have to book him sometime soon.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, and finally, before we go into our duck hunt, we want to mention a couple episodes back we talked about the possibility of doing like a subscription thing for the show, or you know, trying to get pay per episode, or we're trying to figure out what to do about like money and subscriptions and things like that. And what we decided to do for now is like we want to keep the episodes open and for free. Like, you know, the show is continuing to grow. Like, we want to just keep it out there. We like the SoundCloud platform, and we want to keep that as open as possible. But what we're going to do to start is do a Patreon. So, like, the episodes, like, we're going to keep that open for now, but like, we want to do a Patreon that should be up, like, within the next week. Like, when you listen to this, we hope to have it up by then. And, like, what we want to do is, like, for subscribers, like, for, like, $5 a month to get into the Grey Wolf, you know, inner circle. Like, in addition to the shows, which we'll keep for free, we're going to have some premium content for you every week. And, like, that will be, for instance, like unedited or like the fully unabridged version of some of the interviews we've done, like that Derek Davison interview we did last week. Like, there's probably another half an hour of it that wasn't even included in the version that you heard. There's going to be like additional duck hunts, additional reading series, like every week for the people who kick in to support the show. We're going to have some premium content, hopefully, as a little incentive to do that. But even not, you know, just support us. Why don't you? Who can't afford $5 a month?
I've got to keep my family together here.
Oh, did we also mention that all three of us have been fired from our jobs this week? Maybe we should have said that at the beginning of the show.
For speaking truths.
I got fired as the Secretary General of the Volcel Gaming League after it came to light that Center for American Progress also funds that.
Amanda Marcotte found a couple of my tweets and sent it to my manager, the foreman at the dick sucking factory, and he informed me that I just take the dick out of your mouth. Well, don't even finish. You're fired.
Give me your gun and your knee pads.
I was fired from my position as an assistant manager at Arby's for unilaterally creating unisex bathrooms.
You went out on your shield, though.
I did. I wrote or died for the concept of toilets.
Bathroom warrior.
So yeah, be on the lookout for the Chapo Patreon coming soon, and remember, give your money to Chapo.
Bang.
Okay, so to close out the show this week, let's hunt a duck. There's a fat juicy duck in our sights this week.
Yeah, you guys know this duck. I mean, this duck. You can make its mating call by making the sound of two buttons of a Henley shirt rubbing together, by making a pattern in the grass that looks like a horseshoe balding pattern that should have been shaved years ago. We're talking about none other than the Safe Space Master himself, Jonathan Chait. Jonathan, you came out this week in support of Matt because, hey, it makes sense. You've been fucking bitching about Safe Spaces and PC Police for the last 8 years. Well, I mean, really only 10,000 people that like you and 30,000 people that hate you have been reading it. You later rescinded your support of Matt because you thought that he's been involved in an online campaign of rudeness, just invalidating every shitty fucking article you've ever shat out in the last 5 years.
I think Jonathan Chait got on to the whole like PC police beat because he needed something to wield against all the people who were younger than him and write about the fucking Iraq War so that he never had to confront his own monstrosity in that regard. So I'm glad he's found his niche there. But Jonathan, if you have any honor at all, you will submit yourself to a duel with my son. You will choose sabers, pistols, but your son will duel my son for honor.
Chait, I'm going to lock you in a basement with 15 Oberlin gender studies majors, and you're going to watch the Oscars until the end of time.
Oh, and Jonathan, one more thing. When the Brunig hashtag daughter is born, a.k.a. Maudib, a.k.a. the Kwisatz Haderach, their hashtag daughter will be born with the memories of all of this and everything that you've said and done. And basically will use their mind power to like burst every blood vessel in your head at the same time. So there's really no point in doing any of these other things for you because, you know, you're already done, buddy.
Jonathan Chait, your hairline looks like a crop circle. Your face looks like a non-playable character in Diablo 1. Go fuck yourself.
All right. What do you say? Till next week, guys?
Till next week.
See ya.
Bye-bye.